Ladies and gentlemen, this episode of See Here is brought to you by Alice's Restaurant.
The new episode of See Here. I've forgotten what number it is. Morris, can you...
It's 28.
28. Hey, episode 28 of See Here. All right. My name's Bernie. I'm in the UK, and you just heard Morris there.
Hello.
Hello, Morris.
I believe I can get anything I want out of this episode.
Apparently so, yeah, yeah. It's just around the back as well. Maybe we should edit that bit out. And over in Seoul, in South Korea, we've got Tim. Ghetto Tim. How's it going, Tim?
How you doing, Gus? Looking forward to talking about some Mr. Arlo Guthrie tonight.
That's right. This month, we are talking about Arthur Penn's 1969 film, Alice's Restaurant, based on the song by Arlo Guthrie. So, here we go, I guess.
Hi, how you doing? I'm Arlo Guthrie, and you've probably listened to or heard about a thing called Alice's Restaurant. Now, as you know, Alice's Restaurant is about some friends of mine, Alice and Ray, who live in a church in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where Alice ran her restaurant. Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. It was the name of my song about the restaurant.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant.
And now, it's the name of a movie based on my song about Alice's Restaurant.
You hippie perversion!
What's that funny smell?
What funny smell?
It's all about that beautiful Thanksgiving dinner, which produced an incredible, amazing pile of garbage, which we tried real hard to dump at the dump. Which we ended up dumping off the side of a road, where we were caught red-handed by some local citizens and eventually confronted by none other than Officer Obie himself.
Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage.
Just want to know if you had any information about it.
Well, yes, sir, Officer Obie. I cannot tell a lie. I put that envelope under that garbage.
The boss's under arrest.
It's all about the subsequent full-scale police investigation, complete with 5 police officers, 3 police cars, 1 police dog, and 27 8x10 colored glossy photographs with a paragraph on the back of each one used as evidence at the subsequent trial, which resulted in my conviction, a black mark on my record, which eventually led me to my problems with the draft.
Turn your hat and cough. That ain't enough.
That's all I had.
What do you think you guys say particular bus driver? What do the resident officer name any other thing you guys say?
I mean, I'm sitting here on the Group W bench because you want to know if I'm moral enough to join the army, burn women, kids, houses, children, and villages after being a litter bug.
Kid, we don't like your kind. We're going to send your fingerprints off to Washington.
So I'm inviting all of you to meet me and Alice and Ray and Officer Obie and all kinds of groovy people doing all kinds of groovy things that are all part of the Alice's Restaurant anti-massacre movement that you can join by digging this film or by singing the song in 4-part harmony with feeling. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant.
You can get anything you want.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant.
can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
Alice's Restaurant, when did you guys first become aware of this? Were you fans of Arlo before the film? Did you see the film first?
So I think it was back in 1989 or 1990. I was visiting a friend in Sydney, and he had the, I can't remember if it was the soundtrack album or if it was just the regular album, because there were two albums of Alice's Restaurant. But either way, yeah, I suspect it was probably like the regular album. And it had, you know, that full 18 and a half minute story tale, whatever you want to call it.
And the massacre.
The massacre. And yeah. I mean, look, given that I grew up in a house where I had two sisters who were devotees of folk music. I mean, one was definitely into more American sounds and the other one was into British sounds. But the fact that Arlo had never really crossed my path, I mean, and you know, Woody certainly had. It was just, it was incredible to me that it took until, you know, 1989 before this song, you know, was in my ear holes, as it were. And I just felt, I absolutely fell in love with it. And then I found out a little while later that there was a film made based around the song. And I couldn't find it anywhere in those VHS days. And I think back in 1996, while Joanne and I were traveling around the world, we ended up in New York and walked into a Tower Records, and they just happened to have a VHS of Alice's Restaurant. So I thought, oh, I've been waiting for this film. Okay, yep, went and bought it and took it home to watch in Australia. It was a little bit difficult, though, because the American system is NTSC, and we had PAL, so I had to watch it with all these funny green colours, because as we members of PAL Watching Nations, Bernie, we like to call the American system never the same colour. So
that's right. You would have needed a multi-region VCR player, wouldn't you, to watch that correctly?
Correct. And a TV to accommodate it, so it was...
Yeah, it was a little bit difficult.
So, yeah, 1996 was when I first saw the film. And I'll leave it till we sort of like get into discussing our thoughts about the film to say what I thought about it initially. But, yeah, so the song back in 89, 90, and then about 6 years later before I actually got to see the film.
What about you, Tim?
I go back to the 70s with Arlo, actually, because my dad, he was a big, he wasn't a big folky, but there was a lot of stuff my dad dug. He turned me on to, like, when I was a kid, hearing Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road by Loudon Wainwright.
Nice.
And then some of the early albums that Arlo had put out. And I remember that my dad had actually had a music book of the guitar tablature for Arlo for Alice's Restaurant. And actually, I remember that in the guitar book, in the back of it, they actually had the legal citations that they got hit with for dumping the garbage, like, you know, the actual paperwork of it in the back of the guitar book. And then they had a little drawing on a napkin of, you know, as evidence of, you know, them sitting in court of the truck dumping the garbage over the hillside and all that stuff. Like, it was, you know, I saw this stuff when I was maybe like 5 or 6 years old. Because my dad, like I said, my dad was big into Arlo at that time. And as a kid, I grew up with Puff the Magic Dragon, who were the Weavers, you know, like, I mean, with Pete Seeger, who happens to be in this film. And also, you know, Pete was another one who, you know, we used to see on Sesame Street as kids. He was on there a couple of times. But it was through Pete that I found out about Woody. And my dad had listened to a little bit of Woody. And then I found out from my dad that the old man was his old man. So I had seen Alice's Restaurant, I think, now probably about 75 or 76.
Oh, way. Okay.
That was the first time I'd seen it. And since yesterday. Yeah, it was quite a trip. You know, I mean, there wasn't anything I remembered in it aside from the story, the initial event. But yeah.
Well, I first came across it in, must have been very early 90s, about 91, 92. We had just got like a cable, actually satellite TV as it's known over here, but it's effectively cable TV. And it showed up on one of the movie channels. And I'd heard of Arlo Guthrie. A friend of mine had an Arlo Guthrie LP. It wasn't the Alice's Restaurant one. It was the one with the motorcycle song on there, which...
Running down the road.
Yeah, the one about the pickle. I don't want to...
Right.
Eat a pickle.
You know, actually, that album... Right, that album actually had a gatefold of Arlo on a dirt bike.
And
we actually had that hanging in their living living room when I was a kid. Arlo with a tie-dye t-shirt, you know, like riding dirt bikes, right? Yeah, it was great. Yeah.
So, yeah, I happened to catch it on this cable station, and it hit me at just the right time, because I would have been like 19, 20 years old, and I was... Obsessed is probably too strong a word, but I was certainly very, very interested in this kind of period in history, that, you know, the kind of 60s, the counterculture, right. the music. I kind of refused to listen to anything that was released post 1971 at this point. So it just hit my sweet spot. And also, I was just kind of the right age, because, you know, a big part of the film, and we'll get onto this, it's, you know, it's finding yourself. What do you do? What's in store for you? You know, it's just kind of becoming who you are and becoming self-aware, which was a big part of that counterculture trip, I suppose,
right,
for the youth. And so it just really sort of struck and resonated with me. And I've been a big fan of it ever since. Again, like you, Tim, I haven't seen it for maybe not quite 35 years, but probably a good 10 years.
You know, I'm surprised I haven't seen this sooner, because I'm a big fan of Arthur Penn.
Sure.
And I've always tried to see everything that he's done. And this was a film that completely just went under the radar for me. And I just completely forgot that he had even directed this. I mean, after seeing, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and Little Big Man and so many of the other things that Arthur Penn had done.
He's not the kind of director you would imagine.
No.
On a project like this.
No, not at all.
Wait and Clyde, as you could imagine, isn't it?
Right. So, that would be like, it's kind of like Sam Peckinpah directing Can't Stop the Music. You know?
it would have come up for a much more interesting film, though.
Oh, man, yeah, I'd, sure. I'd pay good money.
Absolutely.
To see that.
So
anyway, I suppose at this point I should give a little plot summary of Alice's Restaurant. It's based on a song written by Arlo Guthrie, which was supposedly based on real events when Arlo and friends went to visit Ray and Alice, this sort of older couple that they knew in, I believe, is it Stockton, Massachusetts?
Right.
This couple, Ray and Alice, had bought a church, and it was kind of like a sort of crash pad.
Commune.
The commune kind of thing for all the hippies and freaks in the area. And Alice's Restaurant, the actual song, or Alice's Restaurant Massacre, as it's known, is two parts. One part is about Arlo's induction into the, or going for his medical for his induction into the army and how that works out. And the other part is about Arlo and friends trying to do a good deed, getting rid of some garbage for Ray and Alice, and ending up being arrested and having to go to court for fly tipping, essentially. And so the film weaves those two events into a longer storyline, which I don't know, I hesitate to use the word narrative because it's quite episodic in a way.
Yes.
Yeah, it's about Arlo and Ray and Alice, and Ray and Alice's relationship with each other, with Arlo and the other freaks. Whilst this is kind of going on, you've got Arlo's relationship with his father Woody, mm-hmm. who is in the hospital, time's running out for him, effectively he's on his deathbed. And that's kind of it, I suppose. Where do we go from here?
All right, well, I'll come up with a few thoughts.
Yeah, please do, Morris.
I wanted to say that, in a way, this film qualifies as a See Here film in the same way, I guess, that Suburbia did. That it's less of a music film per se, but notwithstanding the fact that it's based on a song, but it is about the counterculture where music was very much a core part of the values. So I guess in that way, it sort of say qualifies as a, you know, See Here discussion.
Yeah.
So coming back to Arlo Guthrie, I mean, you know, by rights, I should have been a huge fan of his entire back catalogue once I discovered the music. I just sort of want to digress for a little bit to talk about his music.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning rail. 15 cars and 15 restless riders, three conductors, 25 sacks of mail. All along the southbound Odyssey, the train pulls out at Kankakee and rolls along past houses, farms, and fields.
His music, he was sort of different in a way to what a lot of the other folk writers and folk singers were doing in the 1960s, because whereas I guess a lot of music, especially the late 60s, they were rejecting their parents' values. I know that often, like, the band is often cited as one of those rare breeds, you know, where the values of yesteryear was their image. It was completely what they were about. But whereas, you know, a lot of the bands of the late 60s and the whole psychedelic and counterculture movement was sort of a rejection of what their parents had gone and brought them up on. And yet you get the feeling that Arlo was sort of trying to work within the realms of where folk music was then going. But it's still, he couldn't help but embrace his father's music and values. Yeah, I mean, for crying out loud, he was the son of Woody Guthrie, the man who wrote This Land Is Your Land, the man cited as one of the greatest of American songwriters. And I think, you know, would it not be, you know, it'd be fair to say that This Land Is Your Land is really something like an American national anthem.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
It's, you know, the song where you don't have to be a nationalist to say that you're proud of your country by embracing that song, because it's inclusionist. And, you know, certainly that was something that Woody had greatly achieved. And I think what is interesting about Arlo's music is, you know, he still sort of embraces some of Woody's values, and yet he sort of goes and takes things with Alice's Restaurant and the motorcycle song, but he calls it the motorcycle, the pickle song. He's not above, you know, bringing some level of humor into his songs. I mean, I guess It could be argued that Woody did that too.
I don't want a pickle, just run around on the motorcycle. And I don't want a tickle, I'd rather ride on my motorcycle. And I don't want to die, just want to ride on my motorcycle.
To me, Woody always kind of took that kind of Will Rogers attitude. You know, that kind of wry, you know, sneaky kind of subversive humor with some of his music, you know, that was really subtle when he was trying to make a serious point, you know. And that's why, you know, earlier in the week, you and I were talking a little bit about Arlo. And I made the point that, you know, I thought that some of Arlo's observations and writing to me is kind of almost like Mark Twain, too. When he's going in for his medical, he's just like, you know, and I was probed and prodded and this and that and the other thing. Yeah. And they weighed this and they did that. You know, like that's I could see, like, you know, Mark Twain doing something like that. Like it's just this, you know, kind of man from his own perspective, you know, like, you know, who stands out. And it's just like Arlo just has this kind of quirky way of looking at things that's really kind of funny. And it's the same way that Woody did too.
Really feels like that that kind of folk storytelling tradition, doesn't it? He's bringing that into his music, but applying it to the situations that he's in. And he's got that natural sort of knack and gift for doing that, I think.
Right.
I imagine that as well. I mean, I've already gone and said, well, for crying out loud, he was the son of Woody Guthrie, but there's a scene in the film where we see, you know, Woody, he's dying there of, Hodgkinson's disease?
Yeah, the Huntington's Korea.
Huntington's disease. And you see that one of the visitors in the hospital is, you know, Pete Seeger. And it is in, the actor obviously is not really Woody, because
Woody
wasn't. But it really was Pete Seeger who they bring into the film to sing Pastures of Plenty and the Car song, singing to Woody as a visitor in the hospital. And I imagine that all these great folk singers were getting together on a nightly basis, and it was a bit of a hootenanny at the Guthrie household.
I worked in your orchards of peaches and prunes, slept on the ground neath the light of the moon. On the edge of
How's he doing?
Your city.
It was getting worse, but now he seems fine again. We just don't know what to expect, and we're gone with or when.
The wind. California, Arizona, I make all your crops. Then it's up north to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine. put on your table that light sparkling wine.
Every time I've listened to the song Alice's Restaurant, the music, the name that comes up to my mind is Mississippi John Hurt. And we were talking a little bit about him before we started recording. But that that talking blues thing, that's very much a Mississippi John Hurt thing. And that melody, that style of finger-picking guitar playing, that chord structure, that's very much in the Mississippi John Hurt wheelhouse. And
absolutely.
I've been a fan of his for, you know, like 20 years or something like that. I first heard Salty Dog Blues and just absolutely fell in love with that stuff, and bought a great anthology and thought, wow, all these songs, they're so good.
There's that one bit in the film where Arlo's friend Roger rents a room, and it's just him and Arlo in the room, and Arlo's got the kazoo. Yeah.
And he's playing that.
That's totally Mississippi John Hurt. I mean, like, just that whole styling, the way he was playing, you know, it just, you know, you know where it comes from.
Right.
You absolutely know where it comes from. Yeah.
I went up there. I said, shrink. I want to kill. I want to kill. I want to see blood, gore, and guts and veins in my teeth. Eat dead, burnt bodies. I mean kill. And I started jumping up and down, yelling, kill, kill. And he started jumping up and down with me. We were both jumping up and down, yelling,
kill, 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 kill. You're a boy. Right this way.
We only got one question. You ever been arrested?
And I proceeded to tell him the story of the Alice's Restaurant Massacre with full orchestration, five-part harmony, stuff like that, other phenomenon. He stopped me right there. He said,
kid, have you ever been in court?
And I proceeded to tell him the story of the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, explaining what each one meant. He stopped me again. He said,
kid, I want you to go in there and sit down on a bench that says Group W.
So let's talk a little bit about the film itself. I mean, do you think the idea of basing an entire film on what is essentially a song, does it work? Does it work as a framework that they kind of drape the other parts of the story on? What do you guys think?
It's a good question. And okay, so this is where I'm going to start getting a little bit critical of the film. Okay, so there's two issues here. One, we have an 18-minute song that they have to stretch out to, I think it's a two-hour film. We're not even talking like an 80-minute film or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's just under, isn't it? It's about an hour and 50,
right.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, this two-hour film that, and essentially the Alice's Restaurant Massacre, you know, the song turns up somewhere in the middle of the film and in some ways seems to sort of be like, oh, shit, this is the film of Alice's Restaurant. Yeah, we have to include the story of the song, and then now let's get back to the other stuff that we want to pad it out with. It almost seems like an afterthought. So I don't know how you guys felt about that. And the other thing I wanted to make a point, and certainly I'd be happy for a long discussion about this, depending on how you guys feel, is that the tone of the film is very different between the events that we hear from in the song as are represented in the film, which is humorous and blackly satirical, but a good chunk of the film is devoted, as I think you mentioned, Bernie, to the relationship between Alice and Ray, and also the relationship that they foster with the hippies who come and stay in their church, in their commune. And that's a lot more, I won't say dark, but a lot more serious in tone. And I'm not saying that you can't combine a film with some dark moments and some humorous moments. I mean, you know, Woody Allen, once he went into his Bergman period, was doing that all the time. It almost seems like, okay, here are the events of the song, they have to be humorous, so you're expecting that. Okay, now we're going to go to these other things. And there was a character in the film, was his name Shelley, this guy who is the motorbike rider, and he's I don't know if he suffers from depression or he's just, you know, this miserable type who he's...
Well, he's a, I think
he's an addict.
He's a recovered drug addict, isn't he? Yeah,
yeah, right. He's an addict, right.
His kind of recovered addict personality is sort of painted in very broad strokes, isn't it?
Very, very broad strokes. I mean, yeah. I'm not saying that, you know, that character, that his mood can't sort of work for mm-hmm. that character, but we're never really given any time with him to sort of to see how he develops or have it explained to us that, well, yeah. because he's yeah. just because he's a recovered addict, this is why he is who he is. It just sort of seems like he's this miserable guy. He comes into the church, and it's funny, you know, there's that line that Arlo says towards the end of the song when he's, you know, getting the audience to sing along, you know, you can have anything you want except for Alice.
Well, yeah.
In the film, it's like you can have anything you want, including Alice. And
yeah,
I believe the real Alice Brock was not terribly happy with how she was portrayed in the film.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was
apparently
something
that
to do
is
with...
that is the case. Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they did take some real liberties with the writing of the film. Well, and apparently the actual events in the song were kind of slightly different to the real life events. But from a character point of view, and I guess to make it more dramatically interesting, they certainly changed things.
Mm. I think it all fits together for me, and I mean, I don't know if I'm going out on a limb here, and there's two main issues here. There's idealism and there's reality. And I think the whole thing about it is that Arlo, to me, when he goes the whole film, even though he's a young person at this time, to me, he's one of the smartest people who goes through everything,
yeah.
through all of it, because he really keeps his head and he's more of an observer than a reactor. I mean, he's the one telling everybody to cool it, and he's the one that is just kind of like, no, this is not working for me. And I mean, he can see the writing on the wall in a lot of situations, right? And he, in the beginning, he's hanging with one of Woody's friends, his female folk singer, where she's talking about, oh, yeah, the days when I used to sing with Woody, and we all used to get together and play, and then she wants to try to come on to Arlo, and she's like,
you don't find me attractive?
No, I don't.
I don't find you much of a performer either.
That's cool.
But I think the whole thing about the film, to me, is that there was this idealism about Alice's church in the restaurant. And I think that there's a polarity between Alice and Ray, where Alice is more of the reality. And Ray, he can't get over
it. Isn't he?
He's the idealism, you know.
That's exactly what I was going to say, yeah.
And I think he's, you know, he's the guy that's still, you know, well, Alice will take care of you. She'll feed everybody. Go in the kitchen. Alice, just cook them all something to eat, you know. And then she's looking at him like, yeah, are you serious? Like, fuck you, you know, like. And I think the thing is that Arlo is the guy that's kind of caught in between worlds, you know, where he sees...
Well, he can see both, can't he? Yeah.
Absolutely. And even when, you know, he goes in for the draft, you know, it's kind of like there's the idealism and then there's the reality. I mean, did you guys note who was the sergeant there? One of the sergeants there?
Yes.
In the Emmett Walsh, yeah. There's the idealism or the ideas of the Vietnam War. And I mean, they slightly touch on it. There's that moment when Arlo comes into the church and he says, where's so-and-so? Oh, he's back? He's like, yeah, he's sleeping upstairs. And he goes up and he finds his friend with the hook.
There's the also the scene at the kind of motorcycle dirt race where
they're
watching
about
Shelley, because Shelley and Ray are riding in the race, aren't they? And the kind of announcer is saying, you know, we're dedicating this race to all our brave boys who are over fighting for freedom, our freedom.
Ladies and gentlemen, I thought you'd all like to know we're recording all troopers today in honor of all the boys over in Vietnam and other foreign places who are defending this great country of ours.
And you can almost see that sort of divide in the crowd. The kind of hippies are like, yeah, not sure about that. And everyone else is just kind of like,
and they're like, we should go now. We let's get out of here. Let's go.
Yeah.
And they're all leaving. The main thing that we haven't talked about, and it's not a spoiler, but I mean, there's a situation where they have a Thanksgiving dinner at the church. And then Arlo decides that he wants to be the Good Samaritan by actually taking all the trash and everything with his friends. And trying to take it down to the dump. But the dump's closed on Thanksgiving Day. So then they figure, well, where are we going to take this trash? And then they find a hillside and they notice there's trash down at the bottom of the hillside. So they figure that's a place they can dump.
And off on the side of the side road was a 15-foot cliff
And at the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage, and we decided that one big pile was better than two little ones. Rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down.
And they don't. And then they fit. And the thing is, their idealism is that they're doing something nice, you know, and is they're doing something that everyone's just going to see that they're doing a good deed. When actually, what happens is the cops turn around and say, "No, man, like this is a huge crime," you know, like they're looking at the opposite end of it, saying, "You guys are just ditching
on." It kind of is, isn't it? It's this fly tipping. It's, you know, it's messing up the environment. It's doing something really kind of stupid and thoughtless, but with good intentions.
Right. So there's the idealism, and then there's a realism. What would you think about this, Forrest? Like, would you agree or?
Yeah, absolutely. I do agree. I'm going to make actually sort of a different division because you've really gone to sit like about idealism versus pragmatism. But I think there's also something in the film that, and it was very appropriate for the time, that they're taking on old conservative America versus the new generation in America. And I think during the first few minutes alone in the film, they go through it in a very heavy-handed way, but they want to make a point of it. So there are three points that I noted just from the first 5 to 10 minutes before he even gets to Ray and Alice's church. So there's the difference of age, that scene that you mentioned already, Tim, where Arlo and his friend Roger having a little bit of a jam in his room, and he's playing through the kazoo, and the landlady comes in and, you know, complains, and turn off that racket, I want that racket to stop. And the irony is they're playing old-timey music she probably would have been a fan of years ago, but because these are two young men with long hair, it has to be a racket. So there's that division.
And the other part of it too, that also, now that you're mentioning it, it makes me laugh, is like in the recruiting, the draft office, and they put them in with the father rapers and the mother rapers and the rapers
and I walked over to the bench there, and there's Group W is where they put you if you may not be moral enough to join the army after committing your special crime. And there was all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly-looking people on the bench there. There was mother rapers, father stabbers, father rapers sitting there right on the bench next to me, and they was mean and nasty and ugly and horrible and crime-fighting guys sitting there on the bench next to me. And the meanest, ugliest, nastiest one, the meanest father raper of them all, I mean, he was mean and nasty and ugly and horrible and all kinds of stuff, and he said, "Kid,
what'd you get?"
"I didn't get nothing. I had to pay $50 and pick up the garbage."
And then all of a sudden, when the sergeant says something to him, and he says, "Morals? You talking to me about morals when you put me in here with these father rapers and all these people?"
I mean, I'm sitting here on the Group W bench, and you're asking me whether or not I'm moral enough to go burning villages, killing women, killing children after being a litter bug. And
right.
That summons up the whole song and the whole film in one fantastic sentence.
Yeah.
So just sort of coming back to these conservative versus younger generation values. So there, as I mentioned the age, there's, you know, the hair length is a visual cue.
Well, he gets beat in a pizza shop.
Well, absolutely. You know, we get the cowboy hat guys and the redneckism, if that's a word, which I guess is that whole situation is a variation on the hair length, and he's goaded. And yeah, you know, Arlo's not above to throwing a punch, which, you know.
One thing I have to say, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, just when they're sitting in that restaurant and they go right in there and Arlo's sitting there drinking a beer and it's over to those two cowboy dudes, I'm thinking, holy shit, I didn't know John Voight was in this movie. Because it looks like Midnight Cowboy, right?
And yet, actually, the connection is M. Emmett Walsh was in both films.
Right.
Well, there you go.
But it's kind of funny.
6 degrees of M. Emmett Walsh.
They're looking at him like he's effeminate. Meanwhile, these two guys look like gay hustlers, right?
Absolutely.
They look like Tom of Finland drawings, don't they?
Right, exactly. Yeah, big time. I just thought that was hilarious, man.
Hey, honey, what happened to your long-haired girlfriend? He was thinking of asking you two for a date.
Don't rile her, Jed. Can't you tell she just came from the beauty parlor?
So I know I'm harping on about this conservative versus new generation America, and yet where they come together is the theme of Amazing Grace. Because you sort of see, like, Arlo is making his way up to Ray and Alice's church, and he passes by one of those revival tents, and it's, you know, all, you know, the old
preacher's really going for it, isn't he? Yeah, right. Fire and brimstone.
Correct, yeah. What was the name
of that? How bad do you want to get into heaven? How bad do you want to get into heaven? Yeah.
What was the name of that English? Oh, Ian Paisley. Sort of reminded me of Ian Paisley.
Yeah.
But he gets them all to sing Amazing Grace. But, of course, before each line, it's like, I have to remind you what the words are. But Arlo is looking in on that. And he's not looking in on them with contempt or anything. Like, this is to him, it's an old folk song probably that Woody had sung to him, you know, many years ago as a child anyway. And then later on, when Ray and Alice are renewing their wedding vows in the church, what do they sing? They sing Amazing Grace. That song is a nice tie between old world values and new world values.
Just what I've always wanted.
A restaurant?
No, a friend with a restaurant.
So Alice is very much a mother figure towards those kids. Ray thinks that he is one of those kids. He wants to be part of the new scene, the group.
Peter Pan.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like cool dad, isn't he? He's trying to be part of this and into all this, but it's not working.
I forgot right off the top of my head now the actor's name who played Ray.
James
Broderick.
Who is the
father. Right, because I remembered him. He was the father in Family, you know, because that was the show I remember the 70s, right? Yeah, and he, you know, because I thought, like, I know this guy. I remember, holy shit, he was because Kristen McNichol was the little girl, and I remember that show, yeah. What you're talking about, Morris, the conservative and, you know, like that whole kind of crux, I think that a lot of that is also represented in Woody dying.
Right.
Because with Arlo going to the hospital and seeing Woody on his way out, it's almost like the old guard is on its way out. It's a symbolic piece that shows Arlo, like, you know, and that, all right, he's done. He's got to carry the torch. What I find ironic, too, and no spoilers, but, I mean, obviously, you know, Woody dies, but somebody else passes away as well. But then there's a point where Arlo kind of gets stuck in between, where he doesn't make it back to New York to see Woody off, but then he doesn't get back to the church either say good. To me, that's kind of saying, look, it doesn't matter whether you're there or not. Time goes on. Things go on. You're being part of it is irrelevant. It's just, you know, there's just that progress of time. Time just marches on. There's nothing you can do about it.
It's interesting that the film, now, I don't know whether this is with hindsight or whether this is with something that was actually, you know, Arthur Penn was intending, but he kind of shows both sides of the coin in the kind of conservative, the old guard, and, you know, the kind of new generation, the new guard, the more liberal thinking.
Yes.
He kind of shows warts and all on both of them, so one isn't necessarily better than the other.
No.
You know, he's not idealizing the new attitude, as it were, the counterculture.
No.
He's kind of showing that, you know, that's flawed, and that's just as human and, you know, fallible as the old guard is, you know?
Sure, absolutely. But everybody's making assumptions about each other. I mean, like, you know, for example, like that local cop, where, you know, the cop eats the cake, you know, and says, eat me. And he says, all right, no, I don't care. Like, and he cuts the cake. But then later, you know, when the cop gets all serious and he gets up in Arlo's face, and Alice is like, oh, come on, man. Like, what, are you suddenly decided you want to be a cop now? Like, you know, you never hassled us before. Why are you hassling us now, you know?
Yeah.
And she makes the assumption, I think, that, you know, he's just going to be cool all the time when, you know, like, people aren't like black and white. They're gray. And everybody in the whole film is like that, you know? It's that there's people that think Arlo's going to go along with certain things, and he says, no, it ain't cool, you know? And then there's things where they think Alice is going to go along with things, and she says, no, it ain't cool. So, I mean, you know.
And yet Ray is still – he's very much a black or white person. He isn't a shades of gray. He very much wants things to be – wow, this is his new spirit. I'm all up for that.
That's interesting because it's almost like he's making that decision that he's either going to be black or white. He's kind of not acknowledging those shades of gray.
He's not.
Right. But
it's like a conscious thing on his part, isn't it? So either he's all in or he's all out kind of thing, you know?
But I think it was you, Bernie, who had already gone and mentioned that Arlo was, you know, very much the sort of character who, you know, he's going to judge each situation on his own merits, and he's going to be a gentleman. And if this situation calls for, you know, the new values, then good. And if this calls for the old values, well, then very good. So this isn't giving something so much away, but it is very late in the film. So Ray and Alice, they renew their wedding vows, and Ray is being something of a dick at the wedding, to put it mildly. And like, Alice is looking at him thinking, why did I renew my wedding vows? I don't know. And Ray comes up with this idea. So, hey, we're going to sell the church and we're going to buy a plot of land and everyone's going to live so we can be near each other all the time. And it's going to be beautiful and wonderful. And Arlo and his girlfriend is, you know, okay, Ray, we got to go now. Planet Earth is calling us. And so he's still very much, that shows he's the pragmatist, and he comes off looking very, very good.
That's what I was saying about the idea of the idealism and the reality.
Yes, exactly.
Where, you know, absolutely. It's just like he's still trying to get high off his own supply, you know, and he's still sitting there, like he's saying, you know, like, we're going to fill a balloon and everyone's going to go to heaven and we're going to drop flowers and woo. And Arlo's just like, yeah, okay, man, give your head a shake, you know, catch you later, you know. You know, like, and they just duck out. And I think that's the last thing, like, the end of the film, not to give away any spoilers, is that there's this almost like a minute and a half shot of Alice standing at the door of the church looking at them driving away. And it's just her standing there for the longest time. And I think, to me, that's kind of like her saying, yeah, you chose reality, you know, and maybe that was the thing that I should have chose as well. It's like, what's left for me now? I've got to deal with the idealism.
Yes, I've got to live with it. Absolutely, yeah.
Right.
Outside of the scenes which are depicted already in the song anyway, I'd say just out of the rest of the film, that last 3 minutes of the film, and it should be stated, it's just that one image of Alice, although it's a very slow pan of her sort of going
just stood outside the church, just
in front of her, panning to the side, and just the look on her face as everyone's driven away, and she's realized that she now has to live with this idealist, this unpractical idealist, just the look on her face, and we hear a bit of the music. I have to say, that's probably my favorite bit in the film. It's just this look of realization. It's hugely powerful. I loved it. One bit of trivia, not related to any of that. Did you guys realize that the guy playing the judge and the guy playing the cop,
Officer Obi,
it was the real cop and the real judge?
Now, it's really interesting that, I mean, the judge is only in it briefly, but Officer Obi, it's really interesting that he played himself in the film, because they kind of make him out to be a bit of a buffoon, don't they?
Well,
and he's happy to go along with it, you know?
Well, in this interview that I read with Arlo in Rolling Stone from last year, he said that basically, you know, Obi, he heard the song when it all came out and heard the reaction to it, and then he sort of realized, you know, that the whole situation, what he did was pretty stupid. And when they heard that they were going to make this film, they approached him. And he said, yeah, you know, that situation was pretty stupid. I'm happy to play myself in the film.
There was a quote, I think he said, wasn't it, if anybody's going to play me as a buffoon, then it better be me.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah.
I found that really fascinating. I guess in summary, there's a lot of great ideas about the film, but I think it was yourself, Bernie, you said at the beginning of the show that it's very episodic. And it's because the song, even though it's in two halves, definitely has a story, and we get these two distinct things, and it links back to itself. And I understand that you've got to stretch the story out and give us more of the characters and all that, but I'm not sure that it always worked in principle, because it was too episodic, or because the tone was too different from the humor of the events of the song.
I think it just about gets away with it. The tone is definitely uneven, and the episodic nature, I think, does kind of work. I think as well, and this is something I wanted to get onto. I wanted to talk about the performances a little bit, because it's very apparent that a lot of the people in this either weren't actors or were amateur at best.
Right.
Apart from Ray and Alice, I think those were pretty much the only two who'd had any real acting experience. Arlo is kind of quite painfully wooden in places. I think he has a sort of charm, a boyish charm, which kind of carries him through, and I think actually adds to his performance and to the film in general.
Definitely.
But I was just curious as to what you guys thought about him, Arlo in particular, and the rest of the cast.
I mean, look, you've already gone and said it there perfectly, Charlie Burney. He was charming. I don't often use the word delightful, but really he was. And
he did look very stoned in places, didn't he? There's a couple of scenes where he's got the real bags under his eyes and he's really got that one joint too many kind of look. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he definitely acquits himself well. I mean, he is playing not necessarily himself, but a version of himself. And he's certainly playing, he's playing the version of himself that's in the song. And he you know, he says, "Now, friends, we would have had two possibilities. One, which would have been Officer Orby was rewarding us for being so brave and honest on the telephone." And it was that sort of accentuated character. And it works because we get that character from the song. And we get that moment, that beautiful moment, where we see him in the recruitment office. And he's jumping up and down. We're getting a bit in the song where he says, "Shrink, I want to kill. I want to kill. Shrink, kill, kill." And we don't hear him say that in the film. But we do see, like, from outside the glass window, we see him jumping up and down with the psychiatrist, the army psychiatrist.
Then he says, "You're the one, boy. Come with us."
It works in a very old school Hollywood comedy sort of way.
Yeah, absolutely.
I imagine that it's the sort of thing that Gilbert Gottfried would look at and say, "That's comedy genius. You know, that's comedy gold."
Yeah.
So it works in.
I think that's something that maybe Arthur Penn would kind of brought some of that to it as well, considering that. You know, he'd been around, well, I guess he wasn't super old or anything at this point, but he'd certainly had more of a history in film than anyone else involved. So
right.
That whole bit is almost like something out of the Marx Brothers, though, because they say, you're the one, boy, you come with us. Oh, and it's like, okay, yeah, you're good. Oh, by the way, have you ever broken the law? And then he's like, well, like, you know, as a matter of fact, and it's just like, well, okay, that's fine. But, you know, like, have you ever gone and stood in front of a court? Well, you know, then finally they're like, all right, over there.
I agree that James Broderick and I think it's Patricia Quinn, they carry themselves off, you know, well as actors, and Arlo through his natural charm. And look, the rest, it's a period piece, and the acting is a bit wooden. I mean, the woman who plays as his girlfriend, I think Tina Chen was her name. There's that one line, actually sort of brings up the point, apart from Alice, there's no real women of any consequence in this film. So he comes in to get her when he has to leave the town as, you know, as escorted by Officer Obi, and he comes in to see her.
I have to pick up my chick, he says, doesn't he?
"Hey, come on, I'm getting rid out of town by the vigilantes, and I told him I had to pick up my girl."
Am I your girl?
Well, I guess you're going to have to. It's a little bit wooden. But, you know, I really don't have a problem with the acting being wooden, because I think it's that sort of film where they could get away with it, and it's not supposed to be the sort of film where the performances are paramount.
Right. You're not watching this looking for Max von Sydow, okay?
That's right,
I was originally, you know, but...
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, too, that the one thing that really did stand out for me about, like you said, it was a period piece, but here's the thing that, I mean, people need to understand is that when film is made, you know, it's going to be, like, it's going to be viewed for ages. So the thing, for anybody who lived in that time, who went through the draft, who experienced the commune experience, you know, they could watch this and just reminisce, you know, and it's almost like putting on an old jacket.
Authentic, isn't it?
It's going to ring authentic and say, "Yeah, I remember that guy," or "My buddy was like that dude," or "He hit me up for $20 and, you know, had a joint in his pocket and we sat down," and, you know, like, it rings authentic. But for people now, like you said, like 50 years some odd later, you're watching this and it just seems so stilted, right?
Yeah.
But I think, you know, but again, this was made for a time, like Morris was saying. So I think you have to look at it like that.
Well, I think in a way it's kind of one of its strengths, because it is genuine. It is authentic. It's not some Hollywood casting director's idea of what the hippies looked like and how they spoke and what they wore and what they thought. You know, these are genuine hippies hanging around a church in Stockton, Massachusetts in 1968, 69. So it doesn't get more authentic than that.
"Alice, do you take this man to be your lawful loving man? For bad or for better, for drunk or for sober, for high or for lower, for husband and lover, today and tomorrow, till death do you part?"
"I do."
So anything else you guys wanted to add? That's briefly, sorry, I just jump in here. Arlo wears some of the worst shirts I think I've seen. He's got some real Seinfeld puffy sleeve shirts going on in a couple of scenes in this.
"My whole life is ruined because of the puffy shirt."
Everyone else looks, you know, dressed down hippies, but he's got the kind of like powder blue giant, roughly shirt and stuff on. So, but hey, you know, it's the 60s,
yeah,
I guess.
I was going to say there's one moment in this film that's a little bit creepy to me, too. And it's when Arlo, he's hitchhiking and he gets picked up by a truck driver. And he sits down and then the truck driver is like, you know, like looking at him. And then he takes off his hat. His long hair kind of flows out. Then the truck driver's still looking at him. He looks kind of like John Wayne Gacy, you know, the truck driver. And he's sitting there and he fires up a cigar and he's still looking at Arlo and he's smoking and looking at Arlo. And then he turns on the radio and it's foggy. He's still looking at Arlo. And I mean, you know, and I guess that goes back to that division you were talking about, Morris, the conservative and the...
The conservative and yeah. the new generation.
Right, right.
You do kind of expect the next scene, though, to be Arlo's broken body lying in a ditch.
Right.
Cool. Well, any final things you guys want to add then?
Well, would you recommend it? Would you guys say this is a recommend?
Maybe if you're going to think of watching it, just realize it is a period piece. I mean, unlike some other films where I've said like two thumbs up, we do the thumbs up scale on this program. I'd give this, you know, a one thumb, not a two thumb, but I'd say if you're interested in seeing a document of the period, then definitely give this a watch. If you're a fan of the song, then I'd just say go in a little bit cautious, knowing that it doesn't maintain the good humor of the original song. You're getting something a bit, you know, a bit extra, which is, you know, maybe not necessarily bad. Possibly if you've not seen the film or even heard the song, I'd say possibly watch the film first so you're not carrying the luggage of expectations of what the song brings and then go listen to the song afterwards and catch the mood of that. So look, I'd say, yeah, if you haven't seen it before, and the whole film is on YouTube, so it's easily accessible. But so I'd say, yeah, look, I'd recommend it with reservations, but yes, I'd say, sure, go and check it out.
Don't go into this expecting for performances, because I think there's only like about maybe 5% performances in this film of Pete Seeger and Arlo, but it's minimal at best.
I think, you know, viewing it from 40-odd years perspective now, I think a lot of what you could term as bad points actually kind of add to it. I think the clunkiness of some of the dialogue and the acting just give it a more sort of genuine, gritty feel in a weird kind of way. I think it works, again, this is with hindsight, I'm sure, but it works very well as a kind of snapshot of the dream as it was coming to an end, and that dawning realization that we're actually not going to change the world and maybe this isn't going to work out. And because of that, it's got a very sort of melancholy vibe to it, I think, even with the humor and the fun. And well, like we were saying, the tone is pretty uneven throughout, but it generally does give off this kind of end of the 60s, an end of an era kind of melancholy that for me it works really, really well. So I think I'd give it two thumbs up. I really like this film. I like how it looks. It's where it was shot, Stockton, Massachusetts, and they obviously shot it around kind of autumn into the winter. Lots of foliage and trees going brown, and again that's kind of a metaphor of it all, you know. It's summer's over, man, and autumn's here and winter's coming, you know. So I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but
no, I think it's a very good interpretation. I'd certainly say like that last shot of Alice, the last three 4 minutes of the film,
that is beautiful and powerful, and that kind of sums up everything I've been saying about the film. And, you know, again, broad strokes here, but that sums up the entire sort of generation and the counterculture and, you know, what happened. Again, I don't know whether Arthur Penn intended that at the time, but certainly looking at it now, it's a very, very strong image, those last couple of moments. So I love the film. I would give it two thumbs up.
Okay.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed this. I mean, going back after seeing it since I was like a wee kid, I mean, you know, I thought this was great. And what was really nice about it is, you know, you see all these young people together, working together in the church, and they're painting and they're cooking, and they're all doing everything together, and nobody's taking selfies of each other.
You say that with humor, Tim, but that's absolutely right. It's people being together and doing stuff together for the greater good.
And experiencing, sharing an experience. Absolutely. I think the film suffers from trying to be too much at the same time. And I think that, you know, the disjointedness, I mean, like, there's the seriousness in the film about Shelley. There's the seriousness about Ray and Alice. But then there's also just kind of like a whimsy about Arlo.
Whimsy is such a good word. That perfectly encapsulates Arlo's situation.
Again, it's interesting you say that, Tim, because that kind of unevenness makes it work better for me for some strange reason.
I like it too. But I'm saying some might be put off by that, you know.
But
to me, this might sound weird to you guys, but did you get the vibe almost like Arlo's almost like Buddha? Like he's just got that.
I quite thought of it that way, but
no. But he's got this. That. He doesn't go one way or go another. He just kind of, you know, walks through like, you know, everyone expects him to be a certain way, and he's not.
Just
you know what I mean? Yeah, he just observes. And then when somebody says, what do you think about this, Arlo? And he's just like, well, blah, blah, blah. And everyone's like, oh, okay. You know, like,
he's kind of a Buddha, but influence, isn't he?
He's like a philosophical savant, idiot savant, almost kind of, like, he's just kind of walking around just like, yeah, well, whatever, man. Like, you know, whatever. This is what I think, you know? And everyone's like, oh, okay. You know,
well,
like,
I suppose he's the there's a term for this. I can't remember what it is, but he's the character in a film that basically you, the viewer, are supposed to be.
Yeah.
I don't know what the term is, but there's a specific term for it, isn't there?
There is. I mean, I'm thinking like in what do they call like the Greek chorus? Is that what it is?
Well, doesn't the Greek chorus kind of doesn't that comment on certain things or highlight certain things for you to
isn't that the
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe. Hmm. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, you get my point anyway. He's kind of the he's your eyes throughout the thing, isn't he? He's kind of level-headed one way or another.
The last thing I want to say is that watching this kind of gave me almost a deja vu to like the Dukes of Hazzard, because what I mean by this is like, have you seen the Dukes of Hazzard, Morris?
I avoided it at all costs.
Okay, well, anyways, there was a narrator in the on the series, and it was actually Waylon Jennings who did the narration on the show.
Yeah,
but it was like every episode would be like, "Well, them Duke boys are in a lot of trouble now. What are they going to do now?" Like you know, and it almost reminded me like the Dukes of Hazzard, like the narration in this film. I just thought it was so funny. Yeah. It had that kind of like that third person kind of just sitting back like the fly on the wall, like, "Well, how are they going to get out of this one?" And it was just kind of funny. But no, I highly recommend this, all right? So
okay.
Go out and see it.
I guess at this stage I'll mention what we're doing next month. I've picked a film which I guess, like this one, although it came a few years later, is grounded in the counterculture. And I guess I'm breaking the rule a smidgen a bit here, because I think when we established C here, we decided that the film had to be in some way about music. And this film is not really about music, but it is a musical. In fact, it's a rock opera. And the film is called Catch My Soul. So I'll go into the circumstances when we talk about the film on the next show, how I discovered about this. But the film just got released after years in the wilderness. I don't know whether there'd been a print available anywhere. A release company called Etiquette Pictures, which I think is sort of more like a non-sleazy division of Vinegar Syndrome, have gone and released a Blu-ray of the film, which there's a fascinating story behind it. We'll go into it when we talk about the episode, but it's a rock opera. There is some dialogue in it, but a couple of the main stars, it's got Richie Havens, who filmed this, I think, he basically come fresh out of Woodstock. And he was filmed in 74. Forget I said that. Anyway, it's got Richie Havens. Oh, sorry, hang on. I think Richie Havens went onto the stage production after doing Woodstock. And so it's got him and it's got Tony Joe White. So you already have a bit of an idea what direction the music is going to go in.
Sounds good to me.
We're going to have a very interesting discussion about rock operas, and the contemporary films are definitely going to have to come up in the conversation, other rock operas of the time. And it's a counterculture thing. If you haven't seen the film, and frankly, I don't think many people actually did, this is an adaptation, a hippie adaptation, if you will, of Othello. And we've already discussed another musical adaptation of Othello on the program last year, where we discussed All Night Long, which was a jazz adaptation. That starred Patrick McGoohan, and Catch My Soul is directed by Patrick McGoohan, so he obviously has a love of Othello. But anyway, look, I don't want to say any more. We've got plenty that we're going to be talking about in next month's episode, and we will be joined by a guest. Now, this is someone who I've not had any words to on Skype, never met the fellow, but his name is Robert Hubbard, and he's in the See Here Facebook community. When he found out that I'd bought a copy of this, he sent me a lot of information. He had some articles and done all sorts of things in pertaining to the film, and he knew a lot about the background of the history of the film. You know, it seems like he's something of a film scholar. So I invited him to join us. I said, well, if you know a lot about this film, would you like to discuss the film on the show with us? And he said, absolutely. So a new member to the See Here discussion family, looking forward to meeting him. Robert Hubbard will be joining us to speak about 1974's film Catch My Soul, directed by Patrick McGoohan. That'll be June 2016. We will also be having, I'm not sure if we'll do it for June or July, but we're going to have another mini episode, which, look, I might announce on the Facebook closer to time, but just keep an eye out that there will be two episodes either in June or July coming up. It'll be an interview, but something very exciting. If you want to get hold of us, seeherepodcast@gmail.com. Join our group. We're a fun group, aren't we, guys?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah. Sure.
Facebook.com/groups/seehere. And
we want to hear your suggestions. I mean, like, please send us suggestions about, you know, what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, what you love about the show, and some we need film suggestions. The more the merrier. We want to hear from you.
Yeah,
absolutely. If you feel that you'd like to write a review for us on iTunes, go ahead. We'd be grateful for that. But you know what? If you don't want to do that, but you do like the show, tell a friend that we exist. We'd love to get some new listeners onto the show, new people who get involved in the community. Who can, you have an opinion about a film, hit us up. You say, hey, listen, I would like to discuss this film, and I'd like to come on the show and do it with you. We're an open door.
Absolutely.
So please just get involved. It's not just our show, it's our community. Join us, be part of it. We have a passion for films and music, and we'd like to share that with you. So
Sure. Anyway,
that's all the raving I'm going to do.
And with that, I guess
that's it. Yeah,
thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a great
night,
guys.
Good night.
Take care. Yep. Bye-bye.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant, excepting Alice. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. So walk right in, it's around the back, and just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. At Alice's Restaurant.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.